You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 77 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. It's the Vladimir Radmanovich edition of the podcast.
And we have also entered into, some people took offense to us saying that fresh hop season was over. Fresh hop season isn't over.
It was rash. It was an overstatement.
And personally, I don't even think there is a pumpkin beer season. But we have entered into prestige beer season.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, I have a knife in my hand right now.
That's true. I'm a little concerned. You're waving it a little recklessly.
Yeah, I feel a little bit reckless. I have a knife in my hand to cut the wax from the top of the beer, because that's how you know you're drinking prestige beer.
And what prestige beer are we drinking today?
We have with us brand new from Fremont Brewing Company, the Fremont Barrel Aged Dark Star Spice Wars Edition. So they have, every year they put out the Barrel Aged Dark Star. It's one of the most prestigious Fremont beers. And they do a couple of variants every year. And so for this, we have just released on Saturday. We went to the opening party, or to the release party at Fremont Brewing Company. They have the Spice Wars edition, which adds which spices?
Cinnamon, nutmeg, allspice, ginger, vanilla, and clove.
And they have a coffee edition, which I'm going to be aging.
And you should note that while we were there, we saw loyal listeners, Nate and Alicia. Oh. So shout out to them. And also Mike, I'm not sure if he's a loyal listener, but shout out to him anyway.
Well, shouts to Mike. I hope you listen at some point. Okay, so you're going to have to talk while I try to pry this open. I'm going to need both hands. This is like, I feel like I'm on a survival show trying to get this beer open.
So what happened is we ordered one of the Spice Wars while we were there. And I ended up drinking the vast majority of that. You guys only had a couple of sips of it. So it's pretty heavy, that's for sure. Having that in combination with another beer, like I was the only one I think who ordered two beers.
This beer is 14% alcohol.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, you're going to have to drink a little bit more of this than I do tonight, I would say, is my assessment of the situation. But you've successfully negotiated the wax and opened it.
Oh, I'm so excited to drink this. My God, it's just a beast to open in these barrel-aged beers. It's like you've got work ahead of you when you open up a barrel-aged beer.
You probably need something to burn off the 14% alcohol that's in here. So that's why you need a little bit of physical exertion beforehand to successfully open the bottle, which you have now done. And so it's time to give it a drink. Do we have a toast to anything this week besides for Vladimir Radmanovich's amazing Sonics career?
Let's toast to that, because we always have nothing else to toast to this week.
No, we do have something else to toast to, as a matter of fact, but we'll get to that when we get to that.
Do we?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. One thing.
The thing that I noticed, oh, this is good.
You're surprised?
Well, so we had it at the bar, and it felt like it was almost, it's like the Dark Star, but I think the spice is kind of smooth it out a little bit.
I would agree with that.
It's not as bourbony as some of, like the regular Dark Star can be very heavy on the bourbon, and you have a sip and it gives you the liquor taste in your mouth, and it's a little bit difficult to drink, but I think the spices kind of just smooth everything over. I really like that.
And I would say the spices are more noticeable for some reason in this bottle.
Much more noticeable, yes.
In the draft version.
Because when they're in the bottle, they're hanging out, they're mingling, they're moving around. That's why you let it age for a little while.
What? Can we get it out?
That's what the spices do in there. They don't call it allspice for nothing.
And it contains all spices. It's the only spice you need. It's all spice. Hmm.
So I think in the past, calendar year 2016? 15. My number one beer of the year in calendar year 2016 was, I think it was the Dark Star Coffee Edition.
That was pretty good.
And it was so flavorful. It's heavy, but has a lot of rich flavor to it. I mean, this is kind of different. This is almost like it kind of mutes everything out.
In a good way.
I could drink a lot more of this, though. Like, I was worried about drinking 11 ounces of it at first, but now I could drink way more.
I don't want to put a number on how many ounces you could drink of this.
They're going to have this for a limited time at Fremont Brewing Company. I saw they tweeted today that they still have some. But the Spice Wars in particular sells very quickly, so if you're interested, you should get down there ASAP.
Yep, absolutely. Should we start talking sports?
Let's talk sports.
We got a lot to get to today. We've got an interview coming up at the end where we'll drift from sports a little bit, but for now, heavy on the sports. We start with Sonics Arena, and not much of an update this week.
This is the Peltoncast NBA edition, by the way.
NBA preview edition.
NBA preview edition.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second. But first, let's talk Seattle specifically. Not much of an update over the past week. The one thing I found interesting on King Five's podcast, The Sound, which is a great name for a podcast, by the way. Shout out to
we should have considered
kudos
that.
I mean,
look, one of us isn't even named Pelton. I mean, come on. Well, that's, God, what were we thinking?
They had on there both mayoral candidates and asked both of them about the arena situation. And, you know, I wouldn't say anything revelatory necessarily in those comments, but still some interesting things, particularly I would say from Jenny Durkin. Carrie Moon described the Key Arena situation as the first priority because of the fact that it is a city-owned asset. She expressed some concerns about traffic, but didn't mention the Live Nation situation this time, which in the past she's brought up as a concern, the possibility of Live Nation having a monopoly over major concerts in the city of Seattle and the problems that that might create. She did again reiterate her concerns about protecting the industrial land south of the proposed Soto Arena. And, you know, I think it's pretty clear at this point that that Carrie Moon, even if she isn't explicitly saying it, she favors the Key Arena option. Durkin was much more noncommittal, Jenny Durkin, saying, "I think each one of these arenas has positives and negatives, and I'm not ready to say which one I support because there hasn't been enough vetting."
How much more vetting could there be
of the Oakview proposal? I think there could be a lot more.
There's a lot more vetting of that proposal.
And I will say that there hasn't necessarily been vetting of the current Soto proposal because of the fact that it is substantially different from the street vacation request that was forwarded previously and that it doesn't contain any public financing. She also said, "I think they need to look at both proposals in the context of how do we best move forward." So, you know, said that it should be about just whatever is best for the city of Seattle. So again, an openness, I think, to considering both possibilities from Jenny Durkin. And then she also had the comment at one point, "Hockey's okay, but I want the Sonics."
There we go.
And both her and Carrie Moon talked about, you know, the being basketball fans and the importance of getting the Sonics back. So, you know, perhaps something that, you know, and could be impressed upon Carrie Moon is the concern among Sonics fans that renovating Key Arena would not actually bring the Sonics back.
Is that something that we ever heard from Ed Murray in such an explicit way?
No, I don't think so. Interesting. He didn't talk about his fandom.
Very interesting. Wasn't there something else that came out this week also?
I'm not sure what you're referring to, so maybe.
The thing where the...
Oh, you're right. The update on the situation with the street vacation arrest in the Seattle Department of Transportation is the other update that we've had in the past week. So after Chris Hansen came to Seattle, did a round of media, and then also appeared at the public hearing on the arena proposals for the city council last week, the Seattle Department of Transportation put forward the idea that the street vacation request was not being held up because of the fact that there was any, you know, political reason not to forward it, but because of the fact that they were still awaiting documentation from the Chris Hansen Soto Arena group. There's been some back and forth in the media about whether the request for this information was actually made to the Soto group, which we had to have no reason to drag its feet in terms of delivering it. And an email from a person in Seattle Department of Transportation to a member of the city council, you know, described the project as being on hold, and the Seattle Department of Transportation walked that back pretty quickly and threw their employee under the bus publicly in their statement to King 5 about this. But what has become clear at this point is now that you know, as soon as that documentation has been received, which it may already have been, the process will move forward towards forwarding that street vacation request to city council for them to have the opportunity to consider it.
Interesting. Wait, so what does that mean? It means that, like, I'm trying to understand why this would have happened.
Why what would have happened?
Why they would have said that they were waiting on a document that they had never actually requested.
Well, they say they requested it.
It's just a he said, she said situation?
That seems to be the case.
Okay. But now that it's out in the public, the Chris Hansen group understands that they need to send this document and are doing so, which will move things forward.
Yes. And, you know, it should be expedited to some extent by the fact that, you know, if you're looking at the transportation aspect of it, things like that, That planning has already, in fact, been done for the previous street vacation request.
Yes, and this is something that came out of that public forum that was held last Tuesday, correct?
Yes.
Interesting. So it's good that they're holding these public forums and being able to engage in conversations about this proposal. And I think the thing that's interesting to me is hearing both Jenny Durkin and Carrie Moon talking about both proposals, not looking at it, because when you hear the previous mayor's office, you're hearing just conversation about one proposal, saying that the other one is basically dead.
Yes. And the other thing that, you know, why is this, the progress of the street vacation request, important? The reason it's important is because of the fact that members of the city council, most notably Lorena Gonzalez, I think has said this, have, you know, said, well, there's only one proposal in front of us right now, so that's what we're going to consider.
Yes.
If we get a second proposal, we'll consider that as well. So I think there is a logistical element of this that is important to council. So we'll see if that, you know, is forwarded to them by the time they potentially could vote on the Key Arena renovation MOU in early December.
Okay. I have one last bit of expansion news.
What's that?
Did you see the report today that Major League Baseball is considering expansion in both the city that we want to have baseball the most, Montreal, but also Portland, Oregon?
First off, shout out to John Kerry.
Did you see that news?
I did see that news. I mean, there's been talk about baseball expansion to Portland for like 20 years now.
Since that Portlandia episode.
Yes. Yes, very much so. So I take it with a significant grain of salt, but it's good for Portland to be mentioned. I mean, for people there who are hoping to have baseball.
Oh, how badly do we want a baseball team in Portland?
Do we?
We just really
don't. I'm not even sure I like having a baseball team in Seattle that much.
No, it would just be fun to have an actual rival.
It's true.
That's the thing.
Would
is like
the ante.
It would up the ante. I mean, imagine those series against Portland. They would be very fun. And you know Portlanders would love that baseball team.
I don't know. I mean, I think like part of the reason Portland loved the Blazers so much is because of the fact that they were the only game in town for decades.
They've managed to embrace the Timbers also.
That's true. I mean, Portland is, like the rest of the Northwest, is a very soccer-friendly demographic. Is there room for three major league teams in Portland? I'm a little skeptical.
Yeah, there's definitely room. I want it to happen.
You're all in on the Portland baseball trade.
I mean, first off, it doesn't hurt us. What does it matter?
It's true.
But second off, just the idea of
Would you want to go down to Portland to go to a game?
Absolutely,
you
I would.
Go to a game. How many Mariners games did you go to?
I went to precisely one baseball game this year, and the tickets were free.
There you go.
But I would love to go to a game in Portland.
Oh, man.
Imagine the food options in that stadium.
That's
just imagine. Are you thinking about it?
I am imagining it.
Man, it would be so much fun. But right now, the Mariners' rival is the Padres?
Hypothetically, yes.
That's ridiculous. I'm for more sports teams existing on the West Coast.
All right. That's reasonable.
You seem a little bit less pro than
I am. Do you want to talk about this is a diversion, but do you want to talk about another sports team that's apparently coming to the West Coast?
Who is that?
That's the WNBA's San Antonio Stars.
Really? Your definition of West Coast is very liberal, but okay.
Who are reportedly being sold and moved to Las Vegas.
Heading westerly.
I mean, first off, if you're the Storm, and the only two teams you have within, like, at least 1,500 miles. I haven't done this actual calculation, but definitely within 1,500 miles of Seattle. Only two teams are Los Angeles and Phoenix.
WNBA to Portland right now.
I mean, you know, the Fire, bring them back.
Oh, they did have a team.
They did. Okay. They came into the WNBA with Seattle and folded after 3 years. So the Stars were owned by the San Antonio Spurs. They are being sold and then will be relocated to Las Vegas pending approval of that sale by the Board of Governors. And a report today out of Las Vegas that the purchasers will be the MGM Entertainment Group, which is logical because they have a need for teams to play in their arenas. They would play at the T-Mobile Arena.
All right.
So this is important to our friend Kelsey Plum, the former UW star who was drafted number one overall by San Antonio last year. And this interesting implications, besides the fact that she comes back closer to the city of Seattle, closer to her hometown of San Diego, even if you don't define it as the West Coast.
I mean, I've been to Vegas. There's no coast.
That's valid.
There's no coast anywhere near Vegas.
I mean, technically the coast is no. We're not on a coast, technically either. But Bill Laimbeer, who was previously the head coach of the Liberty, will be taking over that team as head coach and general manager. And already they've replaced him with former Storm guard Katie Smith, who was someone I mentioned as a possibility for the Storm job when
really?
It was open. So congrats to Katie on that. But so this is interesting because Lane Beer, historically, like his point guards usually are incredibly good athletes, like tough defenders who cannot score or shoot at all. So very different from Kelsey Plum's skill set. But at the same time, I feel like Bill Lane Beer might have an appreciation for like Kelsey Plum's attitude.
Yes, she's got an attitude.
Yeah, I think that could work well, that pairing.
I like it. So, I thought you were going to predict that Bill Lane Beer would want to get rid of Kelsey Plum and she was going to become the heir apparent to Sue Bird.
I mean, we'd see if the Storm had enough to trade for Kelsey Plum at that point without giving up, you know, one of the Jewel Lloyd, you know.
What is her trade value right now? Still pretty high?
I don't know. It's a good question. Huh. They did a lot last year to try to sabotage her trade value. I'd put it that way. But I don't know if they sabotaged it that far. No, it's a possibility. I think either it's a good thing because of the fact that they'll trade her, or either he'll take to Kelsey Plum or he'll trade her.
Okay.
Instead of the like weird in between that we had last year in San Antonio.
Okay. So, well, let's get to our NBA season preview. This is something I wait for all year long.
So our tradition is that each year I come up with a list of 10 players for you to watch over the course of the season.
And then we never bring it up ever again.
And then you pay no attention to these players. And mid-season, I go through and recount how these players have barely played. Unless they're like Kristaps Porzingis 2 years ago.
Okay, so but I want to do some other things for this NBA season preview.
Well, should we start here? Can we start here?
I just want to talk about the order of operations here.
All right.
I want to do not a glossary. What's the thing in the beginning of books? An index.
Okay.
So we've got 10 players to watch for the 2017-18 season.
Yes.
I want to talk some Blazers.
Yep.
I also want to talk, if you have any interesting statistical things to pay attention to for this year. A couple of years ago, you mentioned to me offline that you thought Dante Exum was going to... Emmanuel Mudiay. Sorry. They're both Rocky Mountain point guards. Was going to break the record for turnovers per game.
No, I said he was going to lead the league.
Okay, lead the league in turnovers per game.
My confidence was misplaced in that. He did not lead the league in turnovers.
So, okay, we've got 10 players to watch. Blazers, statistical curiosities. But I also want to do a book review.
Oh, you're ready to do a book review? Well, I'm not ready.
You're not ready?
No.
We need to do a book review this week.
All right.
So, anyway, let's start with the 10 players to watch. And I want to guess what teams they're on.
Okay.
But, you know, for tradition's sake.
All right, so to go through last year's list, last year we got a little too obscure. Actually, a lot too obscure.
You were just making up four names last year.
All right, so last year's list, Malcolm Delaney of the Atlanta Hawks, Juancho Hernan Gomez of the Denver Nuggets.
And he's good, right?
Yes. Patrick McCaw of the Golden State Warriors, who ended up playing in the NBA Finals. Bobby Brown of the Houston Rockets, who barely ended up playing at all, but is back on the roster this year because he's good friends.
Head coach of the Philadelphia 76ers, too.
That's Brett Brown. He's good friends with both CP3 and James Harden, which is like very good for your employment status in Houston, your job.
Married to Whitney Houston also.
No, different Bobby Brown. Tim Frazier, one of now two Wizards backup point guards on this list, weirdly. Mindaugas Kuzminskis, that was a little too obscure. Alex Abrines of the Thunder, who could be more important this year. Yorgios Papayannis of the Sacramento Kings, who barely played. Pascal Siakam of the Toronto Raptors.
That's the one you definitely made up.
No, he started most of the year for them, and they traded until they traded for Serge Ibaka. And then the other Wizards backup point guard on the list, Tomas Satoransky, favorite of our loyal listener, Ben Bay. Okay, so that was a little too obscure. I've gone
a little bit more mainstream
this year, but there's still some. Okay, number one on the list is John Collins.
Okay.
Guess who he plays for?
The Blazers.
No, that's Zach Collins. Close.
I was close.
There are two rookie big men named Collins this year. This one, John Collins, nicknamed John the Baptist, plays for the Atlanta Hawks. And he was one of the stars of Summer League, just dunking on everybody, showed a lot more athleticism than he did at Wake Forest. And the only reason probably to watch the Hawks this season.
Really? Oh, yeah, the only reason to watch the Hawks?
Bad. They're bad.
Oh, man.
No love for
that. I want to do a Chicago Bulls season preview also.
Number two, Justin Holiday.
Oh.
Our old friend from the University
of Washington. He's on the Bulls, right?
He is on the Bulls. And guess what? Justin Holiday is a sure starter. And there's like a decent chance that Justin Holiday is the leading scorer on the Chicago Bulls this year.
Oh, man. He's playing 40 minutes a night.
Tells you everything you need to know about the Chicago Bulls season.
They've got Justin Holiday and Coupon.
They do.
Why am I not cheering for this team?
That's a great question. Zach LaVine, too. Written zone.
Nah, I'm anti-Zach LaVine.
Anti-Zach LaVine? Why?
Yeah. I'm anti players from Seattle who don't go to UW.
I mean,
the only player who's from Seattle who didn't go to UW that I cheer for is Jamal Crawford. He's done so much work to repair that relationship.
I mean, UW had already recruited, I think that was the Nigel Williams-Goss year, and so he didn't think he could coexist with Nigel Williams-Goss.
No excuses. He probably couldn't have. Nigel Williams-Goss is not a friendly person.
He's a perfectly friendly guy.
Okay, who do we have at number three?
Number three, the first time ever, a repeat on the list.
Wow!
Juancho Hernan Gomez appears again because, like, he gave us a taste last year. And this year, I think we're going to get a little more Juancho excitement.
This is the Hernan Gomez season.
I mean, it was the Billy Hernan Gomez, his brother for the Knicks, had a big season.
So he's in the Nuggets, right, Juancho?
Yes. Billy Hernan Gomez did not make the list this year, sadly. Mm. But
did you have two Hernan Gomezes on the list last year?
No, I limited myself to one Hernan Gomez. But going to play more this year. And I think has a chance to be an important player for what I think will be a playoff team in the Western Conference.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, comfortably. I mean, they nearly missed out last year, added Paul Millsap, got the development of their young players. They're starting Nikola Jokic at center from the jump this year after trying to play him with Jusuf Nurkic last year, which was a disaster.
Is that better? Jokic at center is better.
Yeah, they were. So after Jokic moved to center last year, they played at a 46-win pace in games that he started, or even almost 47.
Let me ask you a Jokic question.
Oh, always.
What country is he from? This is not my question. This is a follow-up question.
Jokic is Croatian, I'm pretty sure.
So you remember in the Olympics, right? That was the Olympics where he had a huge game.
Yeah, that sounds right.
And then I called you to congratulate you.
Wait, no, he's Serbian. Why am I saying that? He's Serbian. I screwed that up.
You just edit that out. Yeah, okay. On Jokic's big day, I called to congratulate you.
He was against the U.S., right? He played very well against the U.S.
You were one of the first people on the Jokic train.
Oh, yeah.
Where does Jokic rate? Have you done an NBA rank with all players? Of course you have. You rated Carmelo 230th.
Me personally or ESPN?
I want to know yours personally, not ESPN's, despite your jacket.
Our NBA rank actually had him higher than I would.
Is Jokic a top 10 player?
No. I mean, relative to his position, he's a top 10 offensive player, but there are legitimate questions about his defense, despite the fact that it rates well by ESPN's Real Plus Minus. So I would have him probably in the 20 to 25 range.
Really? You hate Jokic now?
I do. That's true. I'm a hater.
This is what I'm hearing. Lonzo Ball is probably number 1 through 5 on your list.
That's actually true. No, that's not true.
That's actually true. Okay, who do we have next after Juancho?
All right, next up after Juancho Hernan Gomez, partially because, I mean, his name is so much fun to say, on top of the fact that I was weighing him on stats, Jordan Bell, a rival from the University of Oregon, who unfortunately is extremely exciting to watch.
He's on the Timberwolves?
He's not. He's on the Golden State Warriors.
Really?
And he actually might play a little bit. He started their last preseason game at power forward when Draymond Green was out. And he just stepped in and was throwing passes and blocking shots. He's new Draymond.
He's the new Draymond.
New Draymond.
You love sneaking in a Warriors player so you can say next year that he played in the NBA Finals.
That maybe, I mean, Pat, but no, Patrick McCaw played important minutes for the Warriors.
Is he still
good? In
the
closeout game of the NBA Finals.
A little overrated, Patrick McCaw. Okay. Question for you about the Warriors.
Okay.
I've been hearing some talk. People think the Warriors are winning 70 games this year. Maybe this is the best Warriors team.
It's interesting because the statistical projections all say no, that they'll win fewer games than last year. I mean, that's partially because they're designed to be conservative and regress everything to the mean. And if you're the Warriors, other than Steph Curry can make regression to the mean work for you, but everyone else on the Warriors probably not. So I'm taking the under on 70 wins.
Okay.
That's my bold take. A bold prediction for the season.
Under on 70 wins.
Warriors don't win 70 games.
Okay, I'll be disappointed if they don't. It'll be an embarrassing season if they don't win 70 games.
Why even bother? Why even play?
All right, who do we have next? The excellent minutes that Jordan Bell will be playing.
Next on my list, Joe Chi, the first Chinese player in the NBA in many years for the Houston Rockets.
Oh, you can't say what team he's on.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was going to guess that he was on the Mavericks.
Yeah. that wouldn't have been a bad guess. Huge favorite of the statistical projections from his time in the CBA in China. All he does is shoot threes and block shots.
Oh,
he's great. Every time I see that Joe Chi checks into a game, I'm going to tweet about it and hope that people will turn over to that game.
Every single time.
Yep.
That's Joe Chi alert.
That's human Joe Chi alert, as long as I'm watching.
I like that you have a plan for this already. People wanted to talk about your list of teams that you're watching. We're going to go ahead and answer.
Spreadsheet.
Yeah, your spreadsheet, a tasteful profanity question.
Yeah, Ben B. asked about that.
Tell us about the spreadsheet.
I mean, it's just a spreadsheet where I keep track of each game I've watched, and I break it out like half by half, basically.
It has to be a little bit complicated, right?
So, yeah, you know, it's not really that complicated. And then I just go through and try to make sure that I've watched. My rule is to try to definitely watch every team every 2 weeks. And then my goal was to watch every team every week for a half.
Now, how is that possible when you don't actually watch the games?
That's a great question. And that's because I'm making up the entire spreadsheet. Okay. I'm not making up the spreadsheet. That totally is a real thing. All right, next on my list is the player who's most definitive of this list and why it exists. Because I want to make sure you're aware of how exciting he is to watch.
Okay.
And you're not as into NBA Twitter as I am, obviously. Milos Teodosic.
Oh, man, I've heard about Milos.
First off, there's the opportunity to use the Seinfeld joke about another game for, or I can't remember if it's another game or another win for Milos. There's a tennis player that Jerry plays against
it's
and loses to.
Milos, though.
Yes.
Okay. So Milos was the like tennis player who was actually really bad, but
yes.
Jerry was throwing the game against him.
Yeah, because he was cheating with his wife or something. I forget.
His name was Milos. Okay.
So he throws amazing no look passes.
Where is he from? Where is Milos Teodosic? What's his last name?
Teodosic. He's also Serbian.
But where did he come from?
He was playing in Russia. I mean,
he's a rookie this year.
He was the best player in EuroLeague for many years. He's finally coming over to the NBA.
Because I dabble in the RNBA.
Do you? You know I'm going to be hosting an AMA there. It'll probably be long completed by the time you listen to this because it's Tuesday morning.
Tomorrow?
Yeah.
You're doing an AMA tomorrow?
I'm doing an AMA tomorrow.
Wow, I'll prepare some of my best questions.
They still haven't posted it, so hopefully people actually ask questions. I'm a little nervous about it.
I've got all sorts of throwaway accounts.
Great. Burner accounts?
For my best questions. If you don't work in the Pelton cast at some point, I'll be very angry.
That's fair.
Or whatever my throwaway account at the time is. Throwaway 000012 is going to be very angry. But he seems like, Milos Teodosic, seems like people are treating him like he's a star already.
Well, he's not a star because he can't defend anyone. But
I don't think you're aware of what being a star means in the NBA.
Also, like, the supposition is that he chain smokes and that limits his playing time. His durability is not great. But he's so much fun to watch. Like,
yes.
Just like constant great passes.
Who's the Wizards center who chainsmokes? He's in a bunch of commercials. He's Russian.
George Mershon?
No, this is more recently. Maybe it was on the Knicks. I don't know.
Marcin Gortat? I
mean, yeah, maybe it's Gortat. I don't know.
Think Gortat chainsmokes.
Okay, so the assumption is that Milos chainsmokes?
I mean, I think that's mostly a joke, but there's a reason it's a joke. Let's put it that way. There's a reason it's a joke. But he's going to be great. And he's going to be like hipster NBA fans love Teodosic so much already. He will be referenced on a sitcom at some time in the next year.
You're predicting this right now.
I've already predicted this on a different podcast, I think. I think on Lockdown.
What podcast are you predicting this?
Okay. It's a question of whether it's going to be on...
You're the Worst.
You're the Worst.
The Good Place.
Previously, or The Good Place, yes, which previously shouted out Marcelo Huertas, who may or may not have appeared on this list once upon a time when I gave it to you, or The Good Place, which is focusing more on Bortles humor.
Yeah, really, I'm eating it up.
But Joe Mondé, especially now that he's not on Twitter, may have time to work at a Teodosic.
He's probably quitting Twitter to go spend more time on RNBA.
I hope so. All right, if we're going to get through this list, we're going to get moving.
I love this list.
Did you ever guess who he's playing for?
It's not the Clippers. I know everything about Teodosic, except how to pronounce his last name.
I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Determining how to pronounce this next player's last name.
Okay.
And that's Thon Maker, I think.
Not Maker.
I don't think it's actually Maker.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it's not Maker.
And he's in the Bucks.
Yes. I mean, you know who he plays for. But he's someone to keep an eye on. Didn't play very much as a rookie, but came on late in the season, was starting for them in the playoffs, played really well in the playoffs against the Raptors. And he's apparently practicing threes and doing like fingertip push-ups when he misses them. Like, the stories on it. I never great. And if he becomes like a legitimate 3-point shooting 7-footer who also blocks crazy shots, like, he's going to be awesome.
Now, is it true that he's 40 years old?
I somewhat take offense to these. But I don't take offense, but I
like it.
I get upset about these jokes because, like, the reason we don't know his age is because of the fact that he was a refugee, one of the lost boys from the South Sudan, who had to flee the country because it was war-torn. And that's why we don't know his age. So I don't think it's a real funny joke.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to nickname him Pony Boy. What do you have next?
Frank Ntilikina.
Okay. Yes. I'm all about Frank Ntilikina. He's going to be Aren't good, you? Right?
I don't know. I'm not really sure. He can't. He's always injured.
Is he injured right now? I was also all about a couple years ago. Maybe this was last year. Mario Hezonja.
Yeah.
And he's bad.
No. He's not so Super Mario. So.
And he's on the Knicks.
Yes. Ntilikina missed summer league due to injury.
I'm on fire with what team these players are on.
I think he did play one or two preseason games, but he didn't play any of the games I watched, and he missed their finale. So I think he will be ready at the start of the season. It's unfair to him because the Knicks have no good point guards, so they're going to throw him right into the fire, and he's like too young and not really ready to play. And it's also unfair to him that he got drafted ahead of Dennis Smith strictly because the Knicks were running the triangle, and he's going to get compared to Dennis Smith for the next 15 years, and Dennis Smith is amazing, and that's not Ntilikina's fault, but he's still going to be an interesting player to watch, especially because he is going to play too much as a rookie.
I look forward to that.
All right, next up, another rookie, Jonathan Isaac.
He's on the Magic.
That is correct. Yes. Another favorite of the projections, a guy who didn't play a huge role in his lone year at Florida State, but has the ability, I think, to eventually become like a stretch five, like many of the guys on this list. That's a good way to get on this list, is either if you're an international prospect or you're a stretch five. And if you're an international prospect who is a stretch five, like, you're definitely on this list.
That's the intersection.
It is.
You just said Milos Teodosic was the reason that this list exists.
I know. He is. Anyway.
I mean, these guys you're naming are like top 10 picks. Obviously, well, I know.
Because last year we got too obscure.
It was too obscure.
Overcorrected.
I'm concerned that Lonzo might be one of the guys. I didn't unplug my microphone there.
He's not one of the guys.
Very fired up about Lonzo for this year.
I don't know if I'm very fired up about watching him play. I don't know if I'm very fired up about him being good.
Okay.
So.
Okay, Jonathan Isaac.
Yeah. He's going to play a fair amount for them off the bench. He looks like he's very advanced for someone who is an exceptionally young one-and-done guy. And, you know, he's the Magic's best hope of actually developing a star at some point.
Can he shoot?
He doesn't seem like he can shoot the NBA 3 at this point, but eventually he should be able to.
Just do not draft players who can shoot.
Well, I mean, again, if you play him as a 4 or 5, like, his shooting is good for that kind of player.
Okay.
If you're trying to play him as a small forward, his shooting is a problem. And he shot the 3 well in college. I think he'll eventually get there.
Okay.
All right, the last player on this list is Donovan Mitchell.
Donovan Mitchell.
Hmm.
Man. Went to Louisville.
That is correct.
There we go. I think that's all I'm coming up with. Maybe he's on the Suns?
Utah Jazz.
The Jazz.
Traded up to get him with the 13th pick. And the people in Utah, they love Donovan Mitchell so much. I mean, I obviously was like biased by this because they really embraced him playing the summer league games after Gordon Hayward left for Boston during the middle of summer.
They needed somebody
league.
New to love.
Yeah, and Donovan Mitchell was right there and getting steals against Jason Tatum of the Celtics, and then like trying to dunk on him. He's a very exciting player to watch. I don't know if he's going to be very good as a rookie because he'll be outstanding defensively, but he'll probably shoot like 35%. So that's not great. He's definitely one to watch.
Okay, so can we talk about another rookie?
Who is that?
It's amazing that we've done an NBA season preview for this long and have not talked about the number one pick in the draft out of the University of Washington.
It's true. It's because it makes me sad talking about him right now.
Oh, my God.
So Markelle Fultz appears to have... He's been missing games with shoulder and knee injuries.
Yep.
And it appears the shoulder injury
that
is a real problem.
That all sounds about right.
Yeah. If it checks out for a Sixers first-round pick.
And from his season at UW last year?
It appears that the shoulder injury has caused him to dramatically alter his shooting form, which is very bad now. It looks awful.
Oh, God.
I think he's attempted 3 or 4 threes in all the time he played in the preseason, which is part of the appeal of Fultz to the Sixers, is that his shooting would allow him to play off the ball alongside Ben Simmons, who's acting as their primary point guard right now. So the fact that he can't do this is going to be a problem for him as a rookie, but he probably should be sitting out because it seems like he's actually seriously injured. And I fear that like the Sixers are reluctant to have him sit out because of the fact that they don't want the whole, oh, Sixers drafted another injured guy narrative to start. Especially in a year where they have a chance to make the playoffs.
But also, the Sixers drafted another injured guy, right?
But they didn't draft him because he was injured. They didn't know he was... I mean, the shoulder injury, I don't know where it happened or what, like, but it seems like a problem.
Let's say that you could go back to draft day knowing everything that you know right now, and you're the Philadelphia 76ers. Who do you take with pick 1?
Well, I would have taken Lonzo even then, knowing what I knew then. I thought Lonzo was a perfect fit in Philadelphia, and I thought he was the better prospect. So, definitely now I would take him.
Oh, man.
I mean, it wasn't a great preseason for Lonzo, who also was injured with a sprained ankle, but it's not a long-term concern, obviously,
it's for him. Different than the Fultz injury.
It is very different.
Markel.
So, I mean, I hope that the people of Philadelphia, they're patient. And the good news is, like, I think
they're used to players being injured during their rookie seasons.
Well, the other thing is, like, there's not going to be as much pressure on Markel. He's like, oh, great, you're the number one pick. We already had the number one pick. Like, we've got Ben Simmons, who was the number one pick and is making his QB. Plus, we've got Joel Embiid. Now, like, if things go wrong with their season, then I think Markel could be kind of an issue. But if they, like, have a 500 season, it's not going to matter.
It's all about Embiid, though, right? Like, if Embiid is healthy, people in they'll probably make the playoffs.
Yes.
And Philadelphia will be happy.
Yep.
They won't give a shit about Markel Fultz.
Yep.
If things go badly for Embiid, I still don't think they're talking about Fultz. I think it's just about they'll start to, the Penny Hardaway, Brandon Roy thing will start to creep in of like, can this person ever be healthy?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't even think that as much. I think it's more just like, you know, Sixers injured guys.
Okay, so what about the Blazers? What should we expect from them? Didn't make a ton of changes this offseason. Traded up, I think did they trade two or three first-round picks?
They traded two picks to get the Zach Collins pick and then drafted Caleb Swanigan with their remaining first-round pick.
And so Zach Collins, power forward center out of Gonzaga?
Yeah, they've said they're going to play him at power forward this year because they don't think he's strong enough at this point to defend centers.
But most importantly, what we're getting is a full season of Nurkic.
That's what they're really counting on because they were a totally different team after they acquired him at the trade deadline. So, I mean, I think they will be better than last year. The thing is that the bar for eighth in the Western Conference is almost certainly going to be higher because the way the conference has gotten so much better.
Do you project right now the Blazers to make the playoffs?
I mean, I think they're right on the borderline. Like, in the RPM simulations, it's about 50-50 to make it. So,
who are the teams in that mix?
Utah, New Orleans, Denver and the Clippers, probably a little bit ahead of them, of those three teams. And the reason for hope, I would say, for Blazers fans about the RPM projections is, you know, those take into account Nurkic's last three seasons, which include a couple of years in Denver where he was injured 2 years ago, and then last year was really disgruntled with his role after he got benched for Nikola Jokic and clearly did not try hard. So, you know, Nuggets fans and their organization have been all like, well, just wait till something goes wrong for Nurkic in Portland. But if something doesn't go wrong, and he's worked very hard to improve his body over the offseason, you know, then he's going to be better than he's projected to be by RPM.
So what are you expecting from him, though? Are you expecting a monster Nurkic season?
I mean, I don't know what a monster season entails, but I think
keeping at the same level that he was at the end of last year.
I think that's realistic. Yeah, I think it's very possible. He's got the talent. I mean, he was incredible as a rookie in Denver.
What about the depth in Portland?
So they traded Alan Crabb. That's the one, you know, veteran roster change they made. And that's going to put a lot of pressure now. They only kept 14 guys. They waived Anthony Morrow, who could have been kind of that shooter to replace Alan Crabb. And now that's going to put a lot of pressure on Pat Connaughton, who barely had his contract guaranteed for this year, but had a pretty solid training camp and now might even start on opening night because of the CJ McCollum suspension.
That's one game.
Yeah, but
it's just happens to be opening night. It's like if you were like, oh, he might start in October 30th.
It's still an opportunity for him to establish himself as an important part of the team, and like they're going to need him.
So, any other statistical oddities that we should expect from the season?
I mean, I think, you know, I'm watching where the three-point rate goes. Last year was the highest scoring average in the NBA since, I believe, 94-95. We'll see whether the league, like, takes another step in that regard. I mean, that was, you know, kind of crazy. The scoring average improved, I believe, 2.9 points per game over the previous season, which already at that point, the previous season was the most points in the NBA since 1993-94. So, you know, that and last year then was the most points per game in the NBA since 1990-91.
And because of threes, this just keeps going up.
But it's also a product of faster pace. Last year, there was a really big jump in terms of offensive rating that is somewhat attributable to threes, but also pace has increased. So the combination of those two factors.
Are the Rockets going to take a jump shot all season?
A mid-range jump shot?
Yeah.
Well, I saw that Chris Paul apparently didn't in the entire preseason, which is crazy. Because
that's what he does.
Yeah. I mean, that was his specialty. The Rockets got to doing it. We all thought, like, oh, finally the Rockets are going to take some mid-range jumpers now. And, like, nope, Nope, still not doing it.
It's definitely not happening.
Still not doing it. All right, you asked me if I had any bold predictions for this season.
Oh, you're about to, you're about to drop a bold prediction.
No, I have one. It's like
if your bold prediction is nuclear war happening, then I'm not okay with that.
That's not that. I only have one bold prediction, and it's super boring, but I'm going to put it out here anyway, which is that the salary cap is currently projected at $101 million for 2018-19.
Okay.
And that's causing a lot of panic because so many teams are going to be over the cap and then many of them over the luxury tax, including the Blazers, assuming they re-sign Nurkic, who they did not extend before the deadline. So he'll be a restricted free agent next summer. But so something we learned last year is the cap gets like projected based on the number of playoff games the previous year and not like an average number of playoff games.
Yes.
And that's why the cap went down so much this year compared to the projections. I mean, it still went way up, but went up less than expected because the Warriors kept sweeping teams, and that was a huge revenue driver.
But also there were sweeps in the Eastern Conference,
right, too. So I don't think there's going to be as many sweeps this year. So I think the cap is going to come in like $3 million higher than expected next year.
Really?
Which would really help the Lakers in their attempt to create enough cap space to get two max players. So there you go.
One of them won't be Westbrook. Who cares?
I mean, it might be Paul George.
It could be Paul George. Yeah. I guess that's something. Yeah. But yes, that makes sense. I mean, this was a strange playoffs.
It was.
That we just experienced. So I want to finish things up in our NBA season preview with a book review. I know that you haven't read all of it, but this is such
brilliant.
You've read the Sonics parts.
That is true.
And that's all I really want to talk about.
I mostly skip to them.
That's kind of funny.
Can we say the book?
So this book, Basketball and Other Things, B-A-O-T, by Shea Serrano.
Can we call it a bestseller? It's not officially on the NYT bestseller yet.
It's debuting at number one.
It's going to get there. Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt.
It is a landmark book for our times.
Yes, it is.
Right?
Yeah.
Not just basketball related. This is the most important book that has come out in the last 5 years.
Lin Miranda is going out to purchase a copy of this book. Gabrielle Union is purchasing copies of this book. It's amazing. Brent Berry, our friend of the pod, Brent Berry and Kevin Harlan are shouting it out on TNT broadcasts.
This book that is in my hand right here is the only thing that matters.
Yes, it is.
I mean, they could not have done this any better, right? Both the type of book that it is, the way that it looks at the modern NBA and reminisces of really the 90s NBA, but then also the timing of it, the price point, everything about it was so perfect, right? Plus
the fact that I purchased it for you.
That I really like. The release party with heavyweights in sports media, right?
I just want the book tour to come to Seattle. Is that too much to ask?
We're talking. Shea is there, obviously. Zach Lowe. I hear about him all the time on our NBA. Jason Concepcion at Network.
Yep.
Rembert Brown.
Yep.
Was there anybody else?
Well, like Mallory Rubin, and it was just like hanging out there.
In the crowd.
Like not even part of the panel.
Yelling questions about Game of Thrones to Jason.
Probably.
But also, most importantly, before we talk about the Sonics, you're thanked in this book.
That is accurate.
Was that the first thing that you looked at?
Of course. Come on.
Of course. I've never been in a position to be thanked in a book, so I've never specifically looked for that.
I mean,
I know that people talk about it with records where they look for their name right away.
So I had emailed with Shea a couple of times when he was working on this book. I don't know that any of that made any difference in the actual
book. For some
book.
Stats about Clarence Withers?
No. So
his true shooting percentage?
I suspected there was a chance of it. So I did go check that out.
So right away, where is that, in the front or the back?
It's at the back.
I'm gonna go check it out right now. So you're in some sort of long list of acknowledgments.
Yes. This is really compelling.
Just edit this
podcast material.
Oh, there it is. Right right after Kevin Pelton, Kevin Arnovitz, Kevin O'Connor. There we go.
The run of Kevins.
Yeah, you're one of the Kevins. Well, congrats on being mentioned in one of the most important books of this or any other generation.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And I was honored.
So you've read, I personally am somebody who starts at the beginning of a book and reads it to the end. But you have...
Why do you hate the Sonics?
Skipped through and read the categories, or the sections that have mentioned the Sonics. Where are, and really, Gary Payton and Sean Kemp popping up in this book?
Yeah. So number one, Shea has a listing of the most disrespectful dunks in NBA history. And as you might imagine, Sean Kemp makes an appearance on that list. Makes an appearance very high on that list for a couple of dunks against the Golden State Warriors.
A couple of dunks?
Yeah, well, first off, the dunk where Chris Gatling daps him up after getting dunked on.
Oh, God, that's so good.
And then, of course,
shouts to Chris Gatling, though, for doing that.
Respect to him. And then, of course, the Lister blister where he dunks on former Sonic center Elton Lister, and then
how could anything
points at him.
Be any more disrespectful than that? He pointed at him. That's a personal foul in the NBA.
Read the book. Read the book.
Okay.
Yeah, the only dunk that I have ever purchased a T-shirt of that dunk, the Lister blister. So shout out to it. Then also,
Katie better get busy making T-shirts of a lot more dunks.
The Gatling dunk is ripe. It's just right there for the taking. So also, Shea does a ranking of the greatest, the most perfect duos of NBA history. And Gary Payton and Sean Kemp, as you might imagine, feature prominently in that list. And there's some artwork of them as aviators.
From Top Gun.
Yes.
And where do they rank in the list of...
I don't want to spoil that. Ugh. But again, it's really high.
But like...
Really high.
Really high. I mean, to me, I don't know. We have to talk about this. We can't just let this go.
All right, they're the most perfect duo.
The most perfect duo.
Which is so true. Ugh.
Ahead of MJ and Scottie.
We didn't know how good we had it.
I think maybe we did, but...
No, we couldn't possibly have known how good we had it.
I mean, I guess at... How old was I? 11?
When Kemp got traded?
12?
You were 12.
I probably couldn't really appreciate anything at that age, but I'd like to think that I'd started being nostalgic at the age 12. The most perfect duo of all time playing in Seattle, Washington.
Yeah. Jersey's not retired because of the fact that the team moved. There you go.
I'm going to need a moment. Sean Kemp's jersey is not retired.
I mean, neither of their jerseys are
Gary
retired.
Gary Payton's jersey is not retired.
The Seattle Sports Commission did retire Payton's jersey at the Seattle Sports Star Awards last year.
That matters. Shouts to both Sean Kemp and Gary Payton for not letting them retire those jerseys in Oklahoma.
It would not make sense to do so.
Man, I just could not believe that when you said that they were number one.
It's pretty awesome, huh? Shay knows, man. She's got to have the book tour in Seattle so we can celebrate that.
It'll be like the Sonics coming back.
Something like that.
Be the greatest basketball moment in Seattle since the Sonics last game. Really, since the 2004-05 playoffs.
The last game was pretty great.
I didn't go.
You didn't?
No.
I wanted
to talk about this. Actually,
no, we can't talk about this. We'll talk about it next spring because it'll be the 10-year anniversary.
I want to talk about it. Okay.
Because we also have been going for like 50 minutes here and we haven't talked anything about, like, we've got some grievances to air.
Oh, God. Okay. We do. Okay.
But first, a toast. Can we toast? To the Seattle Sounders FC clinching a playoff berth with their 4-0 win over the FC Dallas on Sunday. And it is the 9th consecutive playoff appearance.
I was going to say, have
Sounders.
They ever missed the playoffs?
Which, guess what? They've existed for 9 years.
There we go.
Every year they've made the playoffs. What a terrific run, even in a league where a lot of teams make the playoffs.
It doesn't matter. Still impressive.
For sure. I mean, you know, the LA Galaxy didn't make the playoffs this year.
Yeah.
A pair of goals from Will Bruin, a brace from him, Victor Rodriguez scoring for the second consecutive match he played, and then Lamar Nagel, Federal Way's own, coming off the bench for the fourth goal in that one as the Sounders dominate FC Dallas. They have now won their last two home matches by a combined 7-0 scoreline. So the other results, perhaps more importantly, or is importantly, went in the Sounders' favor. Both Vancouver and Sporting Kansas City drew, and what that means is if the Sounders win at home next Sunday against the Colorado Rapids in, believe it or not, the MLS regular season coming to a close... Decision day, the Sounders will finish second in the Western Conference and get a first round bye in the playoffs. So here's the thing is, if the Sounders win next Sunday, they go into the playoffs as the favorite to win the West.
Really?
Yeah, I mean...
What about the number one seed?
Well, so whoever wins the Vancouver-Portland match, because those two teams are finishing against each other down in Portland, will get number one. If they draw, Vancouver will be number one. But the Sounders will have better advanced stats than any of those teams. They are number two now in the Soccer Power Index on 538. They are tied for number one in goal differential, according to American Soccer Analysis. Sounders are just a really good team.
Plus, it'll be a cold day in hell before we let Vancouver or Portland beat us in the playoffs.
I mean, Portland beat us in the playoffs.
Never again.
Look, Now, the other reason that buy is important, because of the fact, besides the fact that obviously you just advance, is that you don't have to play that extra game midweek next week. And that's particularly important for the Sounders because injury issues are mounting for them.
Yes.
So Osvaldo Alonso and Jordan Morris both missed this 4-0 win. And then also Gustav Svensson, their other primary defensive midfielder, left with a hamstring injury. So it was interesting. Apparently, the Sounders switched Nicola Ladero to defensive midfield and used him as kind of a deep-line playmaker alongside Christian Roldan.
Really?
Who handled more of the defensive duties in that position. A very effective tactic for them. Not necessarily, I think, one you'd want to see them continue as things go forward here. So the Sounders face Colorado, who last year they faced, you'll recall, in the Western Conference Finals. This season, not as good for the Rapids, who have the lowest SPI in MLS.
Wow.
Are trying to fight their way out of the cellar in the Western Conference in this final match on decision day. And fired their head coach, Pablo Mastroianni, in August and replaced him with assistant Steve Cook on an interim basis. Under Pablo Mastroianni, they averaged 1 point per game in terms of the 3 points for a win, 1 point for a draw. Under Cook, they have averaged 1 point per game. So
Colorado has nothing to play for, really.
Just pride is on the line for them.
And the Sounders have a first-round bye on the line.
Yes. If they lose, it will be incredibly disappointing and surprising. It is safe to say.
Let's say there's a very high percentage chance of victory here.
So it's a cool thing that the MLS has done, that they've played all of their final matches at the same time on the same day. The last couple of years, they call it decision day. That's good. Here's the bad news.
Oh, no.
You know what time they play that match on Sunday?
Is it 1 o'clock?
It is 1 o'clock right opposite the Seahawks, babe. So
it's like they don't even realize MLS. That the NFL exists.
MLS. But, you know, we'll be streaming that one, I assume.
Are we streaming? Are we going to stream it?
Yeah.
This is that time of year. It's like, okay, we'll stream that on the other screen instead of flipping back and forth. We'll still flip to Red Zone.
But it'll be reminiscent of last year when the Sounders faced Colorado in the second leg of the conference finals, and we streamed that one.
I remember that.
And the Sounders went to the conference finals, and then guess what? They won the MLS Cup.
I remember that too. Okay.
The tradition of Festivus begins with the airing of grievances. I got a lot of problems with you people. Now, you're going to hear about it.
All right, so I figured this week, instead of having a separate area of grievances, we should just combine it with the Husky football section. So, would you like me to start?
Oh, God. Sure.
Because I did some research for this one. It's pretty elaborate. A couple of seasons ago on the show Silicon Valley on HBO, two characters, the programmers Dinesh and Guilfoyle, wanted to complain about their boss, Richard Hendricks, while acknowledging that he was still a good guy overall. So they came up with an acronym.
Richard is great, but, you know, R-I-G-B-Y.
Rigby.
Rigby it is.
I'd like to employ something similar when discussing Chris Peterson. I've said before and still believe that there's no coach in the country I'd trade Coach Pete for if I somehow had that power. Nick Saban is the only current college football coach I think is clearly better than Coach Pete, and I'd say I prefer Coach Pete's holistic approach to educating his players about life to Saban's more, let's say, narrowly focused philosophy. So my acronym is going to be WTCPFAB, which rolls off the tongue. Wouldn't trade Coach Pete for anybody, but WTCPFAB, I think he needs to use the Huskies bye week to look in the mirror and acknowledge his role in losing this game at Arizona State. Playing a close, low-scoring game exposed Coach Pete's greatest weakness, that being his unfailing conservatism. Any similarity to another football coach named Pete in the Seattle area is clearly coincidental, I'm sure. As third Pelton brother Zach Whitman noted on Twitter, this game has essentially turned on two fourth-down decisions. Arizona State's Todd Graham aggressively went for it on fourth and one in his team's opening drive, which resulted in a touchdown, and Coach Pete elected to kick a field goal on fourth and two from the ASU 4 down 13-0 with 50 seconds remaining in the third quarter. WTCPFAB, there is no logical argument for that decision. It is inexcusable, indefensible, and unacceptable. Even if the Huskies were able to make a 21-yard field goal, and at this point we have ample evidence that no kicker currently on the roster is able to reliably do so, this is still a decision that costs the team a chance of winning. Using the win probability calculator on profootballreference.com, which I grant is based on NFL data and not college, but is close enough to provide a reasonable estimate, even if you assume perfect kicking, a team improves its win probability by going for it as long as you expect to pick up the first down 24% of the time in that situation. Naturally, the actual conversion rate in the NFL is more than double that.
teams have picked up fourth and two 52% of the time over the last decade. So again, assuming perfect kicking, deciding to kick a field goal in that situation cost the team 8% chance of victory. That is an enormous swing that adds up over the time. There are 1,000 math students at UW who would love to do these calculations for Coach Pete. Heck, they would probably use the college data and look into that if he doesn't trust the NFL numbers I'm using. WTCPFAB, his unwillingness to go by the numbers with his decision-making is costing the Huskies. And when the goal is winning a national championship, they cannot afford to let any advantage go unused. You're broken. You're speechless.
Chris Peterson does not play to win the game. They need to approach these situations as if they do not have a kicker on the roster. They can't look at it and say, at least we can take the field goal. As you mentioned, even if they had hit the field goal, it doesn't increase their chances to win the game.
It significantly decreases.
They're not playing to win the game in those situations. They should approach every single time they have the ball on offense as they are either punting or they're going for it on a fourth down.
They're playing to win the game. They're just playing wrong to win the game. That's it.
Yes, Chris,
it's that simple.
The wrong perspective. It was like, I'm so hot about this on Saturday. There's no way that I even imagined that they were going to kick it on that fourth down. And I don't even understand the basic logic of why they chose to.
I mean, if I could have without a costly loss, I would have rent my garment. I would have torn my Husky putty in two based on that decision. That's how furious I was about my decision. I mean,
it just made no sense.
It was mind-boggling.
And then he missed the field goal.
Yeah, it was bad enough before Vance over to progress the field.
But it's not like when we're looking at this game, if they would have scored a touchdown on that play or on that series, the Huskies would have won this game.
I mean, I don't really it was look at it exactly like that, but yes.
It was the difference between winning or losing. The defense did everything that they should have done in the second half. They held them to 0 points. 0 points in the second half, and you're saying, eh?
I mean, they could have stepped up a little more on the final drive. But yes, it was. I mean, it's very much like a Seahawks game.
Oh, there was like one lucky pass.
Coach Pete is like, oh, they didn't score any points. They didn't score any points on defense. Like, look, your offense is supposed to score the freaking point. Yeah, he said that.
He said they didn't score. Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, he said that.
Chris Peterson, the defense, said the defense didn't score any points.
Yeah.
Do you know who didn't score any points? The goddamn offense.
The kicker would be, I mean,
he
Tristan,
had one.
Tristan Vizcaino did eventually make an extra point.
Are you kidding me? They scored 7 points on offense against the worst defense in the Pac-12.
The worst defense in the Pac-12.
And he talked about, we're like going to wake up everybody in the house.
Imagine if we had done this on Saturday night after the game.
Managed to complain about the defense in some way.
I don't know if he complained about the defense.
That's like Pete Carroll talking bad about every single other person, but never putting any blame on Tom Cable. Just being like, you know what, he just put in a bad situation.
Be like, of a Seahawks grievance.
Russell Wilson should have avoided that person coming at him unblocked. It's like, are you kidding? I'm beside myself that he said that.
Yeah.
That they should have gotten a pick six.
He should have scored on defense. Alabama scored on defense.
That is insane, and an insane way to look at this game. This was a failure across the board, because we've seen a lot of these games where the Huskies have, or the Seahawks really, the Seahawks in this game that we watched, have outgained the other team but managed not to score points. This wasn't even that. The offense didn't even play well.
I mean, they played decently in the second half.
They had a fine second half, but they were still outgained for the entire game. This wasn't the Denver Broncos against the Giants yesterday. This wasn't even the Jacksonville Jaguars against the Rams yesterday.
I don't know. You lost me at some point in this.
No, they massively outgained the Rams.
Did they?
Yeah.
I mean, that partially that'll happen when you give up a kickoff return for a touchdown. And was there also a pick six in there?
Yeah, there was. I think it was a block punt. But we saw one of those too, because the Huskies aren't even good on special teams anymore, Coach Pete.
Arizona State came into this game.
Wait.
120th in the country on special teams. It dominated the Huskies on special
dominated
teams.
Dominated them.
They had a punt return for as many yards as they had the entire season in terms of punt returns the previously. They blocked that punt, as you mentioned. They made a 52-yard field goal, even though they missed a shorter field goal later. And they completely shut down Dante Pettis' returns.
I don't know how they made that 52-yard field goal. That was insane. But we need to look at Jonathan Smith here too.
So
we have Daryl Bevel on our list of on the bingo, but Jonathan Smith should be on there instead, because Bevel's having a fine season. Jonathan Smith is not having a fine season.
I mean, I think the point is that usually we're talking about Daryl Bevel in the context of defending him from haters on Twitter. So
he doesn't even have
haters. It's all on cable. Cable, cable, cable.
I mean, it's more on cable.
Taking the heat off Gerald Bevel for a while. But Jonathan Smith has not been able to get the ball. Granted, you know, Jake Browning is part of this also. But against the worst defense in the Pac-12, they couldn't get the ball to receivers. They couldn't run the ball. They have some garbage carries. LeVon Coleman looked like nothing. Plus, do you know who makes big plays when they're in the game?
Who is that?
Safwan Ahmed! And do you know who, plays in the game, leaves the game?
Is it Safwan Ahmed?
How is that even possible? What are they doing? He makes huge plays and then is out of the game immediately after. They could get him the ball as a receiver. I'm so sick of these passes to Dante Pettis, these screen passes. They don't work.
I don't agree with
that. No, this is the Percy Harvin treatment that they're giving to Dante Pettis. No. They are giving him the Harvin treatment. Why did they attempt a single pass to Dante Pettis downfield?
There's
the one that Jake threw up to the end zone.
I don't remember off the top of my head. I mean, the Dante Pettis screen passes are generally getting 5 to 6 yards.
They weren't here. And then also they gave up on it immediately.
I think they did.
Also, if you're setting up for a trick play, this was the week to run that trick play.
Yeah, that's true.
Why were there no passes down the sideline when they went deep?
I mean, I think you have to wonder.
Why were there no passes down the seam to Hunter Bryant?
I think you have to wonder about the personnel at wide receiver at this point.
Oh, like, I'm wondering about the personnel as the offensive coordinator at this point. Future Oregon State head coach. Let me just say he's a great prospect as Oregon State's head coach.
Look, here's the thing. 2 years ago, Coach Pete went very on the record talking about the problems at wide receiver. They changed wide receiver coaches. They recruited a bunch of wide receivers and talked about the need to get playmakers. And then John Ross came back, and it covered up all of those other weaknesses at the wide receiver position. Well, John Ross is not working through that door, and if he was, he'd be injured at this point. But so you've got Dante Pettis, who's great. Besides him, the second leading receiver for the Huskies this year.
Greatish.
With the 10 catches is Chico McClatcher, who has missed the last 2.5 games due to injury. Beyond him, in terms of healthy wide receivers, Quentin Pounds and Braden Lenius have 9 catches apiece, and that's it. Through 6 games!
Wide receivers are like the anti-secondary for the Huskies. They're unable to develop, because these are all talented players. These are all highly recruited players.
Are they?
But they can't. Yeah. These are 4-star recruits that we're talking about. Granted, there's a million 4-star wide receivers out there, but these are players who are highly recruited that they have not been able to develop into reasonable Pac-12 wide receivers. And they could take anybody and make them a cornerback.
It is bizarre, yes. Including John Ross.
This game was, it was just frustrating to watch because it didn't need to be this way.
That's why it was like a Seahawks game. But yes.
And it also just went on forever. It was like,
it ended after 11 p.m., which made it very difficult for us to record a post-game angry pod.
Yeah, it would have just been us smashing the microphones.
Although I did write the whole grievance at like midnight on Saturday.
You're pounding away.
I was so angry. I couldn't sleep. I was too angry to sleep.
I'm still angry about this. I'm like, I have not let this go.
Haven't you? I hadn't noticed. So should we talk about like the implications of this going forward?
Ugh.
All right, so first off, yes. The notion that this takes the Huskies out of the college football playoff picture, it's wrong. Like, it's a bad perspective, and we're seeing it a lot out there.
We thought it after the USC loss last year. It's just the way it goes.
So if the Huskies win out, 538 gives them an 87% chance of making the playoff. Loyal listener Ben B. pointed out the complete list of one-loss playoff conference champions from a Power 5 school conference who have missed the playoff is none. There is none. That's the whole list. So the Huskies still have everything to play for, but here's the thing is, at this point, we have to wonder whether they're good enough to actually win the conference with one loss, particularly having to play at Stanford, who destroyed Oregon with another huge game from Bryce Love on Saturday night. And that's where the other important implication of this is the two players the Huskies lost for the season in this game. Trey Adams with a knee injury that he suffered midway through, and then Jordan Miller rather devastatingly on a leg injury on basically the final real play of this game, a play in which the Huskies actually should have let Arizona State score from a logical perspective, but
stopped that pass.
That's a lot to ask of college kids to realize in the moment. We did hear from Trey Adams that he plans to return for his senior season, as first reported by KJR Softy. It was interesting. Adam Jude of the Seattle Times on Twitter called Adams maybe the Huskies' second most irreplaceable player, and I don't know if I know about that. I mean, first off, I think obviously Jake Browning is number one.
Yes.
Dante Pettis, given everything we just said about the wide receiver core, is pretty clearly number two for me.
I mean, the thing is, Trey Adams is part of the conversation. You know, it's like Vita Vea would be a very important player. Taylor Rapp would be an important player. And Dante Pettis, but he's part of the conversation. I think that's what Adam Jude is saying.
Jordan Miller is at a more replaceable position where already the Huskies have survived one injury to Byron Murphy, who was so great in the first 3 weeks of the season, with Austin Joyner stepping in for him there. Now, the depth is certainly taking a hit, and you know, without Miller, you're looking at Jamon Dotson, you're looking maybe at true freshman Elijah Molden stepping in there. You're getting pretty far down the depth chart, but the Huskies have basically shown they can take anyone and make them a competent quarterback.
They have a bye week. When is Byron Murphy expected back?
Unclear, but at some point.
Some point. I believe in Jamon Dotson as being able to fill in here.
Okay.
I feel okay with that.
So as we take stock of the team going into the bye week at, you know, essentially the midpoint of the season, you're a little bit past it. I thought it'd be interesting to compare the ratings in terms of the Football Power Index efficiency from 2016 through 2017. So the Huskies, intriguingly, still fifth in Football Power Index even after this loss, which is one reason that that 538's model is so high on their chances of making the playoff. Offensively, they have dropped from fourth to 18th. In efficiency. Defensively, they have improved from 7th to 4th, and in special teams, they have improved to 39th to 5th. 35th, I should say. So I think if you were coming into this season, you would have expected with all the losses defensively, guys going to the NFL, particularly in the secondary, that this team would drop off a lot. Instead, they have actually been better so far this season.
Pretty insane.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, at this point, I feel like I don't know what it is that
that's part of the reason that we don't panic about losing Jordan Miller, because
right.
It's like
done it before.
Yeah,
Marcus Peters.
They've had generations of losing every single person in the secondary.
Yep. But offensively, I would have if you would have asked me coming into the season, I would have said I think the defense is going to be a little worse this year with all the injuries, and the offense will be the same, if not maybe even a little better, only losing John Ross. And instead, they've dropped off pretty substantially. Jake Browning's yards per completion are down from 14.1 last year to 11.5 this year. And their yards per carry as a team have gone down from 5.2 to 4.6, which I think points to the fact that the offensive line has not been the strength that we necessarily expected it to be. And they really just no answer for Arizona State's blitzes in this game.
No, we kind of saw that right away to begin the year. I feel like the line has not been settled at any point where you felt really confident in them.
I mean, that does also speak to the coaching aspect of not being able to come up with a counter to those blitzes.
Yeah.
Other than rolling out Will Dissly. Hitting Will Dissly.
That was
the
only counter. They tried one screen that Arizona State read, right?
Yeah.
Arizona State read the screen, and they were like, no more screens. That's it. But also, what's with an inside screen? I mean, we could just look at this week, they should be looking at somebody like the Kansas City Chiefs playbook.
That's weird for a college team to be looking at an NFL playbook, but you're right.
I want to see Thrill Dissly shovel passes.
Can we do that? Hunter Bryant, maybe?
All Joel Disley. But they should be looking at that playbook and opening things up. They need to open things up. They have to look at getting players into space or just play Savon Ahmed.
Yeah, that'd be great. I mean, I think this is a real opportunity, like I said, in the grievance. This is a chance to self-scout, to look in the mirror and see where they need to get better over the final 5 weeks of the season.
And that's the offense. The offense has to get better. They have to get better.
And kicking.
They're not. You don't just start kicking better, though. That's the thing. There's no coaching that makes you kick better.
It's better decision making about when to kick.
Yes.
For the final five games at home, but obviously the schedule gets more difficult, despite the fact that Arizona State improved in the FPI rankings with that victory against the Huskies on Saturday. Still, the fact remains that I believe every team they are facing the rest of the season is rated better than every team. Yeah, because Utah's the 43rd and Arizona State is 44th. Every team they are facing the rest of the season is rated better than every single team they've faced so far this season.
So now the margin for error is zero.
Yep.
They need to win every single game. I mean, I kind of think that it's nice to get the loss out of the way.
I don't think that.
You get it out of the way early. I'm saying I would rather lose this game than lose at Stanford if you had to choose between the two.
That's probably true.
Because they'll move you up in the polls every single week after that.
And the Huskies didn't drop that far down to 12th. We'll see the first college football playoff rankings come out Tuesday night after this podcast will be released. So it'll be interesting to see where the Huskies
Will be irrelevant anyway, so who cares?
All right, should we talk about the Seahawks coming off a bye week? And this week, heading into facing the New York Giants. So a little bit of news over the bye week that Brandon Elbert We don't know what's happening.
What in the... I was weeding around for news all day, waiting for him to sign. And then he was just never signed. He just flew away.
It seemed like the Seahawks were just waiting after the bye week so they didn't have to pay him during the bye week to sign him. But lo and behold, apparently that wasn't it, as he got the offer but left without signing. And it's interesting, he's one of the teams in the mix to potentially sign Brandon Albert, the New York Giants.
So was it, do you think it was not a good enough offer?
I mean, that seems to be it. I don't know what the other issue would
what
be.
What could he be looking for?
More money. That's okay, what he could be looking for. I think by this point, we've pretty much conceded the Dwayne Brown rumors, as we discussed last week with Brady Henderson.
They kind of popped back up this week, but...
Well, there was like the notion that they were going to trade Jimmy Graham for him, which doesn't seem to be supported by any actual reporting. Yeah, I don't see that one happening. So a team that did make a lot of moves last week, I mean, not necessarily roster moves, but some changes, the Giants, who had their head coach Ben McAdoo gave up play calling duties and handed them off to their offensive coordinator Mike Sullivan. They made dramatic changes in the offensive line where Justin Pugh moved from left guard to right tackle, John Jerry moved from right guard to left guard, and then they moved in DJ Fluker as the starter at right guard. And the result of that, along with the injuries to Odell Beckham, Sterling Shepard, Brandon Marshall, and I guess Dwayne Harris got injured the week before, pretty much every wide receiver for the Giants, they go out and beat the Denver Broncos on Sunday Night Football.
No, I've never imagined moves just flipping all of your offensive linemen around to different places that would work.
It's like the classic like Twitter comment, like, well, what if they just put them in different spots? Just change.
But we need to look at this game for 1 second.
Well, so first off, and I think that, part of what happened here, it's interesting because people have talked about like, oh, without Odell, they were better on offense and all these sorts of things.
No,
they were better on offense. They won this game strictly because of the fact that their defense played well.
I just really hate this. I mean, we were talking about this with the Rams yesterday, where the Jaguars outgained the Rams by like 150 yards. But people were just going to talk about the Rams offense. Even though they had a kick return touchdown and a blocked punt for a touchdown, people were going to give credit to Jared Goff somehow.
He's a winner. What else can you say?
He's just a winner. And the same with Eli Manning, who's 11 of 19 for 128 yards.
Which, in fairness, was slightly more yards per attempt than he was managing with his wide receivers healthy. Yeah,
okay, so they're better.
The fact that Brandon Marshall was so bad, but still 6.7 yards per attempt. That's not going to win you a lot of games in the NFL. And here's the thing. Most of those completions were to Evan Engram, their rookie tight end, had his best game with 5 catches on 7 targets for 82 yards. Their receivers combined in this game. You know how many catches they had? You want to care to guess how many catches they had?
5.
That's way too many.
Lower. Is it?
They had 2 catches on 6 targets for 22 yards.
Who is that? Tavares King and Roger Lewis had one?
That is correct.
Who's Drell Adams?
One of those guys is a tight end.
Okay.
As it turns out. And then also they had a few catches, completions to their running backs in this game. So, yeah, I think that's going to be a problem for them against the Seahawks. If they complete 2 passes to their wide receivers all game, I'm predicting a Seahawks victory. So how were they able to win this game? Well, number one, they ran the ball. Orleans Darkwa with a huge game on the ground, 122 yards, I believe.
117.
On 27 carries?
21 carries.
Oh, okay. So he's averaging 5.7 yards per carry this season. All other Giants...
Also did have a 47-yard carry.
Yeah, but he's still been great all season. They just played him, finally, is part of what happened here. All the Giants are averaging 3.3 yards per carry, and that's really dragged down by Paul Perkins, who has not played the last couple of weeks due to injury, averaging 1.9 yards per carry. That's practically...
He's like the Thomas Rawls of the Giants.
So that was good for them. And then the other thing was their defense finally played well after struggling all season. They came into this game...
Trevor Siemian passed for 376 yards.
Yeah, but he also had 2 interceptions. So they came into this game ranked 27th defensively, and largely because of the fact that they were ranked 28th against the run. Opposing running backs were averaging 4.5 yards per carry against the Giants before this game. They held C.J. Anderson to 17 yards on 9 carries. And the other thing, even though Siemian completed these passes, had 2 interceptions, which was a dramatic change from their takeaways, and then also had 4 sacks in this game, 3 of them by Jason Pierre-Paul, which was half of their previous season total of 8.
He's going to feast. Like, we should be... just. I'm just ready for the film room treatment of Jason Pierre-Paul.
So the Giants' defense has really struggled with tight ends this season. They came in... again, this is not updated because we... we're recording this before Football Outsiders DVOA updates. They came into the game 29th in DVOA against tight ends. This seems like good news for Jimmy Graham.
Yeah.
So I'm excited about that. The other thing that changed a little bit, I would say, on Sunday, the Giants were 28th in special teams DVOA coming into the game. Their punting had been the worst in the NFL, and they were no better than average in the other area, and they got a little bit better in there, too. You know, the best game of the season for Brad Wing. And then Ed Egan took over as punt returner for the injured Dwayne Harris and had a 20-yard punt return on the one actual return he had. So, you know, that was a mildly positive thing for them.
I think, to me, the main thing to take away, and granted, this is the freshest thing that's in our mind, it was Sunday Night Football, et cetera, et cetera. It was a huge win over Denver in Denver. But the main thing to take away from this is that we shouldn't think that differently about New York after the game than we did going in.
Exactly. I mean, this is not a dramatically different team. They are a team that had one really good game. They made regression to the mean work for them to some extent. I mean, they're not as so
bad.
They got
lucky.
They're not
so
bad. They
got lucky in a game. They didn't really regress to the mean that much.
But they were due for some good luck. They're not an 0-5 team.
Okay.
But they might be a 1-5 team. They're probably like a 2-4 team.
I mean, what this game on Sunday is going to come down to is Orleans Darkwa against the Seahawks rush defense.
I mean, I think the big question is, can the Seahawks force this game into the hands of Eli Manning and his experienced receivers?
I mean, they'll need to score to be able to do that.
Exactly.
But the Giants offense is going to be Orleans Darkwa against the Seahawks rush defense. That's it. We're not scared of any of these receivers. Shaq Griffin can defend whomever. Tavares King, Shaq Griffin can defend him.
Got it.
Is it Tavares? Traveris? Shaq Griffin can defend him. The secondary will be fine in this game. We don't have to have any concerns. They can really focus a lot of energy onto Evan Ingram also and not have to sacrifice the tight end and what they've given up before. This is going to come down to, can Orleans Darkwa beat the Seahawks rush defense?
So I think,
and can they score enough points on offense to make Eli Manning throw the ball and make mistakes?
Exactly. I think if the Seahawks rush defense is anything like it was in LA a couple weeks ago against Todd Gurley, then it's a comfortable victory.
Of course. I mean, we've seen the rush defense not play that well, but I do believe that they're in a better place now. And we saw what Todd Gurley did last week against the Jaguars. He was very good, and it was kind of the outlier week was his week against the Seahawks, which is what we want to see.
Jared Goff, again, not very good.
We broke him.
Yeah, let's take credit for
that. We turned him back into the old him.
Seahawks also historically just a better team coming off the bye week and the ability to, as we talked about with the Huskies, kind of reevaluate what you're doing and make the necessary changes going into the second, you know, in this case, it's not the half because there's still 11 games left, but the second portion of the season. So
they've also been very good in this particular stadium.
That is true. And you're not playing on grass, so that's nice.
I'm not going to say that they're going to pick off Eli Manning five times, because I don't think they'll even have the opportunity to pick off Eli Manning five times. But if the Giants need to pass the ball, things are not going to go well for the Giants in that case.
Yeah, that seems suboptimal for them.
So, I mean, I feel good about this one. I feel almost as good about this one as I could feel about basically any road game.
Yeah, I guess that's probably true.
I mean, there are a couple other teams that they could be playing, and they will have to go at San Francisco. But honestly, right now, I would be more scared of them going at San Francisco than at the New York Giants.
I mean, C.J. Beathard looked pretty good on Sunday.
You just compared C.J. Beathard to Eli Manning.
Unironically.
Advantage Beathard!
All right, I think it's time for a quick detour before we discuss chances of victory. All right, we welcome in now someone who was just at an NFL game as we're recording this. Someone who's been a third Pelton brother in the past and is joining us again from Nashville, Tennessee, from the band Bully, Reese Lazarus. Thanks for being with us again.
Thanks for having me.
So, Reese, we wanted to have you here this week. Your album, the first Bully album that's going to be coming out on Sub Pop, comes out on Friday. It's called Losing, and you can listen to it right now, I believe, on NPR First Listen.
You can hear the whole thing.
I didn't know if I should go there or if that would be kind of like spoiling the actual release this Friday.
Oh, not at all. Not at all.
Reese is totally comfortable with it.
If you pre-ordered the record, you got a stream maybe a week or two ago, maybe a week and a half ago via Sub Pop. So the whole thing's been out there for a minute too.
Okay, so you won't be spoiling it. So we just want to talk through kind of your thoughts on the record a little bit with it coming out this week. Was there anything, I've listened through to it, it's excellent. Was there anything that you guys were looking for kind of stylistically that you were doing differently, this being the second record, the second Bully record, as the follow-up to the debut album feels like?
There was a lot of comfortability that happened this time, that we all knew exactly what to expect walking in. It was like, honestly, Electrical changed so little, which is great, that it felt like we walked in like the day we left from the last record. We used some of the same gear, but also brought a lot more of our own. And I think the focus was more, there was a lot more intention this time. I think that last time there was a certain aspect of kind of, like, while we prepared a lot, there was still some flying by the seat of your pants kind of recording stuff that happened. And this time there was not a lot of changing stuff around when we got there or adding new songs. There was just a lot of cutting down what we already had. And like I said, a lot of intention with every sound that you hear, which feels really good from the band point of view.
And when you say Electrical, you're talking about electrical audio in Chicago, Steve Albini's recording studio, right?
Right, yeah, Electrical Audio, sorry. Yeah, same place as Feels Like was recorded, and really recorded not exactly in the same month, but in the same kind of time of year where it's really cold outside and you're locked up a lot in the studio and not a lot of room to move around outside of that.
Do you feel like my impression from listening to the album all the way through was that this record was maybe heavier?
I think the themes are heavier, overall. I think that the music is slightly heavier, but also I think that's coming from my perspective, which is that we were always that heavy of a band, but maybe it came across recording wise less heavy last time. And we've just become more comfortable with that playing live and expected that of ourselves. So maybe that's less of a surprise to me than it is to the listener.
There it is.
Yeah, certainly in concert, it's very heavy.
Right, yeah.
The other thing is, I mean, Alicia, the lead singer of Bully, willing to just shred her voice in songs. But I feel like on this album, there's one song in particular where it's like, oh my God, like, are you okay?
Are you talking about Focused?
I think so. I'm like, yeah, are you going to be able to talk in 5 years?
I don't feel like I'm telling too much talking about it. We talked in a couple other interviews about how brutal the vocal recording was on this. And to go back to like the time we did it, Chicago is dry in the winter. And if you don't get out of that place, it's a great studio, but you've got to move around. And like, we went through a couple different tries at finishing that song, and it was just too dry, and it's a lot to ask. And like, there's maybe 8 more tracks of vocals besides just the main vocal on that song. It was a total beast. So if what you're hearing is like, is exactly what was happening. It was a really tough one for her, and Clay and I were just listening to a monster of a song happen the whole time. I mean, I would argue that that song, of the amount of time we spent recording that song, between tracking, mixing, and vocals, ate up well over its share of what would be like 1/12 of the record. Like, it was probably like a quarter of the record of time recording.
Well, then also, know,
that's
just
an unscientific guess.
Yes. That she's able to recreate it live also. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. No, that was
hearing those screams.
I'm really excited to play that one live.
And you'll be coming here to play that song and the rest of this album live, correct?
Yeah, you'll hear it, yeah. I think our Seattle show is, I just looked this up, February 28th of next year, which is a very long way away, and I wish it was...
Mark your calendars. The MLS season will have started again.
That's right.
The MLS season is back on.
I literally did just put this on my calendar.
Yeah, spring training will be in full swing.
But February 28th at Numos, right?
Yes, at Numos. Yes. I think it's announced you can buy tickets.
Tickets available now.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I have some random questions for you, Reese. I guess first off, are there any tracks that you would recommend on Friday? This will be streaming on all the major streaming services. Tidal. And then also Spotify and Apple Music.
Tidal a sponsor now? No one told me. Are you getting Tidal comped? I'm not getting it comped.
I'm going to be doing a Tidal read in a minute. but are there any tracks that you would recommend people listen to first?
The three singles that came out were all arguably poppier songs on the record. I think Focus, what we talked about, is one of the most developed and most intricate songs the band's ever put out, and it's really great, and we all love it. If you get through the beginning and you want to skip to something, that's a great one to skip to. And Hate and Control at the very end is very topical, also really heavy, showcases the other side of the band. I would skip to that one as well if you feel like you need to move on.
But you should listen to it all the way through.
But again, the first three singles that came out were the first three tracks, and those are, I think, the more, you know, the radio-y, poppier stuff.
Have you been seeing any reviews yet? I don't think I've seen a single review.
Dude, I haven't. It's been crazy. Like, one of the biggest differences between this record and the last record is that we haven't got to play many of these songs live, and it is really hard to tell how people are going to feel about them. We played the first record for like 5 weeks straight in its entirety as an opening set, but to everybody. And it was, we knew like what order we wanted to go in, like all sorts of things that we were really comfortable with. And this one just, we had to live with it on our own. Up until like maybe even 2 weeks ago, maybe 10 people had heard this whole record, I think. Or theoretically, I don't really know if that was true. I have no idea how people are going to react. I was telling everyone else in the band and somebody else this, that honestly, even if it is negative, I feel like we made the record we intended to make, and I'm really happy with it. But I'm curious to see what people say about it.
I'm sure that it will not be negative. I think that the reviews will be excellent once they're in, but it's like, I can just imagine how nerve-wracking it is waiting for them. It's like, we put out a podcast weekly, and I'm like, I wonder what people are going to say.
Tomorrow. No, I don't know. I've been in a lot of different bands, and I've always felt pretty nervous about putting out releases, but I'm really comfortable with this. I don't know if that's good or bad, but I've been way more comfortable knowing that this is done and being very happy about it than a lot of other times.
That's awesome.
I've been in this position.
Okay, this is my last random question about the band. What is the band's drink of choice?
Well, we know with Reese, when he's in Seattle, it's Rainier.
Yeah, well, if it's beer, it's Rainier. Yeah, or Olympia. With our original drummer, we did used to take a Jaeger bomb before every show.
You've stopped that tradition?
We did stop that tradition. I don't think that's happened in a while. But there's still something in you when you're like getting ready and you're like, I really need something extra. You're like, maybe that's what I need. No, I mean, everyone's got their own. I think the Jaeger bomb used to like be a uniter, but I think that the spirit of choice is now tequila or cheap beer, with a preference for Rainier.
Okay, are you able to get Rainier in Nashville?
No. It is a rare treat.
Do you get Lone Star in Nashville?
No.
What is the cheap beer of choice in Nashville?
Miller Lite. Like,
I was gonna guess Miller High Life.
You can get that. There's no good regional cheap beer. Somebody just started this company. This is a sidebar. Sorry. That I saw some coasters of. It's called the Nashville Brewing Company, which is, I swear to God, not a thing until like a month ago. But it argues that it was created in like 1859 because somebody in 1859 like made a brewery called Nashville Brewing Company, and they are reviving their lager recipes. consumption in 2017, and I tried a sip of one, and I'm kind of out.
I mean, something we found out when Rainier went to the Pale Mountain Ale, some of these recipes were discontinued for a reason. It turns out. Yes.
Are you talking about Rainier Ale, the green can?
Yeah, Pale Mountain Ale. It was in green cans, wasn't it?
I think so.
Yeah. Oh.
Those green cans are pretty brutal.
Man, we haven't talked about the Jubilee cans yet, by the way. Have you seen this year's Jubilee cans? Reese, are you coming back to Seattle? You have to have one.
Yeah, I'm trying. I'll be home for Christmas, maybe.
Rainier just tastes better in a Jubilee can.
It does. It's indisputably true.
The two is Rainier tastes the best in bottles because it's kind of hard to find in bottles, and then the Jubilee cans. If it's the Apple Cup and we're drinking Rainier Jubilee cans, the Huskies cannot lose.
Wow. Chase's victory 100%.
Knock on something right now.
So you were just at the, Boys album, losing out this Friday on Sub Pop. Will be on all the streaming services, available, I assume, on vinyl from Sub Pop on Friday.
Yep, you can get the Loser Edition if you order it before that. It's on a really nice black and clear vinyl. You can buy it from Sub Pop. I'm sure you can buy it from your local record store. It'll be around.
And then also February 28th at Numo's in Seattle. Mm-hmm. So anyway, you were at the Titans-Colts Monday Night Football game earlier tonight. I'm just kind of curious how that was.
It was cool. I've only been to one other Titans game. It was actually against the Colts last year, and they lost. And it was very underwhelming. As far as last time we talked, I was talking a lot of proud game about how fun Predators games are, and the Titans game was not fun last year. featured new metal on the stereo.
Oh, no.
Pretty tasteless sports product, but this game was great. I actually had a really good time. They won. I don't, really know what else to say. It was fun.
You said
the crowd was much more into it. Last time it was really lackluster. They wanted this one.
I mean, first time Monday Night Football in Nashville in 3 years, and then also I think the fact that, you mentioned losing last year to the Colts. The Titans had not beaten the Colts. They brought this up on the postgame show when Marcus Mariota came over to talk to everybody. The last Titans quarterback to beat the Colts was right there on set with him. It was our old friend Matt Hasselbeck.
Oh, Matt Hass.
Oh, no way, yep. Really? It was 11 times ago?
Yeah, it's been a while. Yeah.
That they've beaten the Colts either place, home or road? Wow.
Yeah, they've owned the Titans. So
man, this is
power shift in
beating
the
Oregon.
AFC South.
You said you
had, maybe not quite.
You said, Reese, you had gotten into a heated argument at the bar that you were at after about the Colts Titans game, and I need to know what this is about.
I did got in a weird heated argument from, it was me and my friend who were at the game together, and our friend who watched it on TV, and he was trying to argue that the Titans were not in control of the game because they were losing for three quarters, which I think they were losing for three quarters. They might have been in the lead by the time they got to the fourth. But being at the game, I mean, the first half, both teams scored on every drive, besides the last kneel out, I think, the Titans had at the end of that half. And there was some random stuff that happened where they weren't quite getting it in the end zone. The Colts had scored one touchdown. And then Mariota threw the pick six the first drive of the second half. But they had already made the Colts go three and out for the first time. Then they went three and out another time. And then they got forced the fumble. And they still hadn't really – they hadn't scored a touchdown, I think, until – the next drive after the forced fumble. I could be wrong about that. But at the game, the Titans had no problem moving the ball. The first drive, they needed a defensive holding penalty to get out of third down back in their own territory. But beyond that, it really felt like they were going to move the ball at least into borderline red zone every drive. And coming from watching a bunch of Seahawks games, it was kind of crazy to watch. You're like, this is going to happen, and I'm not worried about it. So I was on the other side where I thought they were in control of the game. It was maybe more like the Seahawks-Colts game than it seemed because of that one pick six made it look close. But, that thing that you guys were talking about last week that Frank Clark was like, I was setting up this whole game. It was, I'm like, my BBS. they did the, it kept running this play where they'd bring in an extra offensive lineman, report him as eligible, and then they'd run to his side, and it would just be like a night, like a left side run through, like, I don't know his name, 71. And they did that all game. And then in garbage time, they did it again. And it was like on the third down play, they didn't even really need to get this first down to like, it was going to solidify the win, but the Colts were maybe going to get back with 15 seconds left. And instead of just running to his side, they ran a bunch on his side and then pulled the right guard and he ran all the way over there. And so they had four blockers. And that's when Derrick Henry scored that touchdown. And I would maybe argue they set that up.
That's pretty nice.
And if it came one series earlier, it would have seemed more out of reach.
I think it was fantasy owners who really benefited the most from that. Yeah. I was thinking when he was running that, especially when he went all the way to the end zone, I was like, man, there must be some fantasy owners out there who are stoked.
That had to get it over the over, too. I felt like they were in control. I don't know. I was watching not – maybe it's because I also wasn't stressed about them losing as much as I would be if I was watching the Seahawks, but that was what the argument was over.
All right, we're going to call that the Dennis Kelly gambit since he was the reserve offensive line who was reported as eligible. I also want to note that Tennessee's red zone struggles, really nice if, like me, you picked up Ryan Succop in fantasy league this week. He had an amazing performance.
Five field goals. Yeah. Actually, at the beginning of the second half, I remember looking at my buddy and was like, you know, it's okay. We can score three field goals and still win this game. Like, it's just going to keep happening.
We were talking about the Seahawks earlier and wanted to bring you back in to talk percentage chances of victory. Do you have any thoughts about their – I guess we can talk Seahawks season in general beforehand, but then also specifically this Giants game coming up on Sunday.
I was I'm a lot more up on it after that Rams game. Felt really good watching them win that and coming down to a couple clutch plays. I know that the line came closer after the Giants ended up winning on Sunday night, but I still think this is a really favorable Seahawks matchup, and with the history in MetLife, it's just I feel like it. They have a better chance than like the projected like 55, or in like the 5.5 point line or whatever it's at right now,
which is already pretty good for a road game to be 5.5 point favorites. Did you happen to catch any of Sunday Night Football last night?
I didn't get to watch it.
Yeah, it definitely seems like the outcome of that game flattered the Giants, as we discussed earlier. So, so if you think that the 5.5 point line is too low, where do you put the percentage chances of victory for the Seahawks?
I'm not that much hotter. I was going to give it a 65.
Okay, I think that's probably about in line with that. And that's a reasonable place to be.
And, like, maybe a 7, like, a touchdown line, or like, 7 or 7.5 or something like that. I just don't think Eli Manning's playing well, and he still has no receivers.
Right, yes.
Barring another offensive meltdown, but doesn't even include, like, not moving the ball. It just means turning it over too much.
Is Trevor Siemian
should be well on their way to... Yeah. It should be well on their way to a not exactly the most comfortable victory, but an okay victory.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I feel like I see this at like 75%. I'm more confident than I should be.
Oh, you're...
I mean, we talked about this earlier. It's like, this is a game where Orleans Darkwa is going to have to beat the Seahawks. We just saw the Seahawks defense shut down Todd Gurley, or they're going to force Eli to throw the ball. And I just really don't see the Giants being able to pass any sort of consistent rate in this game. And I think that the Seahawks offense will be able to do just enough to be able to win this game comfortably. Maybe not a blowout, but I think they win by 14 points.
That's probably pretty close to a blowout. I'm going to go also at 65%. I think that's a good place to be going into this game.
I just don't see Jason Pierre-Paul having 3 sacks again.
I kind of do see that.
Definitely
I'm a little scared.
Despite our offensive line, I mean, I don't know. He's got that club. Russell Wilson's going to move a little bit.
Loyal listener Ben B had the post on field goals last week breaking down how every single week some opposing defensive lineman or rush linebacker for 3-4 teams like the Titans gets the film treatment because of the fact that they've had such an amazing game against the Seahawks.
I don't know.
It's coming for JPP. He's going to feast.
I feel okay in my assessment. He's not going to get 3 sacks.
Russell hasn't. The Seahawks haven't given up that many sacks this year. He's probably going to have like 30 pressures and only 1 sack or something.
I'm changing my pick if JPP has 30 pressures. I like the Giants odds then.
He'll have double digit pressures and maybe only 1 sack.
All right, well, on that note, thanks a lot for joining us, Reese, and thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks.